You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and do I have you there, Ted? Ted, Ted, are you there?
I'm here. Okay.
All right, just hold here. I'll go ahead. We're live, but I just, since we were having problems, so I'll just go ahead and get started here, and then we'll introduce you. Okay. This is Truth Quest with Melody, and we're and on KHENLP FM 106.9 Salida. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And if there's any questions for the program, they're at khen.dj@gmail.com. And this evening, I've got a very special guest to kind of follow up with the series that I've been doing on the Franklin cover-up. But there's also a lot of other aspects that I've been dealing with some great researchers and people that have been involved in the child trafficking and things that go along with this subject. But I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my guest this evening is Ted Gunderson, and he's the founder and operator of I'm reading his resume. So he was from 1979 to now, and he's the founder, operator, and owner of an international security consulting and investigation firm. And he's investigated for F. Lee Bailey, and F. Lee Bailey describes Ted as a person with the investigative skills that are unsurpassed by anyone I know or have known. And from 1981 to 82, he was a California Narcotics Authority consultant appointed by Governor Jerry Brown. In 1984, Los Angeles Olympic Committee anti-terrorism consultant. And from 479 to 879, Pan American Games San Juan, Puerto Rico security coordinator, special appointee of United States Attorney General Griffin B. Bell. And let me see if I can turn my mic down just a little bit. And then from 77 to 79, he worked from 1951 to 1979. You worked for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, anywhere from senior special agent in charge in Los Angeles, California, and from 73 to 77, special agent again in charge of Memphis, Tennessee, Dallas, Texas, and 1973 chief inspector, and 1965 to 73 special assistant special agent in charge, New Haven, Connecticut, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and from 60 to 65 special agent supervisor, FBI headquarters, Washington, D.C., 1951 to 60 special agent, and at the time of his retirement, Ted had over 700 persons under his command and operated a $22 million budget. And his publications on how to locate anyone anywhere without leaving home, and then your education and bachelor of science degree, University of Nebraska, with numerous awards. So, Ted, thank you for coming on the program this evening.
You know, I have an expression. All that information you put out there, now that I'm retired, of course, all that information and $1.65 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Well, that, I just kind of wanted to, you get into some pretty interesting investigations, and I think it's kind of good to kind of set your background so that people are kind of aware that, you know, I'm not just talking to somebody that just decided to get in there and start talking about anything and everything without having some kind of background. So,
yeah. Oh, of course. I certainly understand that.
Yeah, so.
And thank you for having me on your show, by the way.
It's a pleasure, and I've been trying to kind of bone up on some of the information, and the more I get started on someone like you, I realize that I could spend weeks.
Well, somebody told me that there's close to 200,000 references to me on the internet.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. But
if you Google me,
there was one particular piece that I was wanting to look at, and I noticed that YouTube had kind of pulled you off of there. So.
Oh yeah, well there's a lot. Well, see, there's one thing about it, a couple things that are interesting because the internet can be a fantastic media communication system.
Uh huh.
But at the same time, there's a lot of disinformation on the media, on the internet.
Uh-huh.
And since I've been very critical of a corrupt government, I want to make it very clear that I believe in our government, and I don't believe in violence. But I am, and I'm not anti-government, as I'm displayed in some instances in some circles, like by the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center. The things they said about me are absolutely not true, and some of the other people, Lynn Horowitz is an example. He's made some very disparaging remarks about me. But these people, as far as I'm concerned, are government agents who are trying to discredit me because of all the criticism I've leveled at this corrupt government that we have. It's not 100%, of course, corrupt. There's a lot of good people out there, but it's there, and there's absolutely no question about it. I've uncovered and exposed, drug operations coming out of Southeast Asia in the 1980s late 60s and early 70s and so forth. They're bringing drugs in from Afghanistan right now in body cavities of dead GIs, according to one of my sources. And a child kidnapping ring called the Finders, which was conducted, it was exposed back in quite a few years, a couple decades ago. And there was a U.S. Customs report. The person who wrote the report was involved in the investigation of the Finders. That's kind of a long story, and I'll get into it if you want me to. But at the end of his report, he said that it had been exposed as a child kidnapping ring. And at the end of his report, he said that the investigation of the Finders would be conducted internally by the CIA. Well, why would the CIA conduct an internal investigation of itself unless they were involved in it? So. Yeah, I've exposed these just a few things that I've done, and I paid dearly for it in some instances because of this disinformation about me on the internet. But I'm not complaining because that goes with the territory.
You know, you spend a lot of time with the FBI, and to find that you're kind of getting into investigations that kind of put them in a light at times that makes you wonder. What side of the fence you should be on. I mean, obviously you had to believe in the government and the system or you wouldn't have put that kind of time in, correct?
Well, no, I still do believe in it. It's just that it's unfortunate that you see, when our forefathers established the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and so forth, they established, set up the judicial, legislative, and executive branches. Little did they realize that years later, there would be a fourth branch, which I call the covert, rogue, criminal government enterprise. And these are people that have infiltrated into our government and are involved in these nefarious type activities like child kidnapping, satanic cults, and drugs and what have you. And it's there. I mean, it's plain as you can. Yes, no question about it. It's just very, very, I've documented it. And I urge people to go to my website and look at my DVDs, and I understand also that I have quite a few of my lectures on YouTube. So the documentation is there, and I am what I am,
okay,
regardless of what you might hear about me on the internet.
And your website is what?
It's tedgunderson.net.
Tedgunderson.net.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And are you actively working on any cases right now?
Yes. I've been involved in a case that's kind of interesting. You see, because of the work that I do, people hear about me, and it's kind of like a magnet, and people just are attracted to me as an investigator. And one of the most interesting cases I've had in years is the John Van Meter case. And John is a logger that cuts down trees and sells them and so forth in northern Wisconsin. And Halloween night, He'd been in Sonoma County, California, Santa Rosa, for a conference, and he was driving home, and he saw five or six cars, black cars, kids, young adults in the cars dressed in black, pull off the highway and go into the wooded area. And he drove on, and he thought, this is strange. And so he did a U-turn and came back, and he parked a safe distance away. And he could see that they had set up, they had a fire, and they had a girl nude tied to a tree. And they were nude also, the participants. There were 15, 20 of them. And somebody shot at him, and John, being a woodsman, carried his gun with him with plenty of ammunition. And the long story short, he got in a gun battle with these people. It was a satanic human sacrifice of this young, beautiful girl. And so he ended up shooting four of them and chasing them and rescuing the girl, put her in a car and told her to take off. And then he chased the leader into the woods and ended up shooting him. And so there are five there that he shot and killed. And then, just a minute.
Okay, I'm speaking.
Hang on just a minute.
Okay, I'm speaking with Ted Gunderson, and he worked for the FBI for a number of years, and he's dedicated his life to a lot of significant investigations. And since 1979, and has been involved with the Franklin cover-up, which I've been covering a little bit, or covering in the last two weeks prior to this. And so my purpose and what I'm trying to do here is to try to present to the public that there's a lot going on out there, and these particular type of case where it has been dealing in child trafficking and satanic occult ritual, which I really haven't, we have hardly even touched the surface of on this one, but trying to expose the fact that there's a lot going on around us that many of us aren't paying attention to until it's, you know, kind of put in our face or happens to us. And what I'm finding out is these sort of cases seem to get covered up. And so my purpose in trying to present this is show that, you know, these go down to local levels a lot of times when people try to report cases like this. And the fact that we don't, they often get covered up, and you know, you may get somebody that wants to investigate it, and then often they get pushed aside by somebody of higher authority. And this isn't just happening on a local basis; it extends to happening around the world on an international basis. And often these cases tie into significant high-ranking people, because I'm finding out that there's a symbiotic relationship between the underground or corruption, and they will use anywhere from drugs to sex to pornography, you name it. So, Ted, are you back?
I'm back.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Well, Ted, you're much more interesting than I am, so.
I'm listening to you. I'm doing the radio show in the bathroom. My daughter had to come into the bathroom. I had to leave. Sorry about that, Coach.
Oh, well, see.
But anyway, let me kind of finish this story. This is kind of an interesting case.
Uh-huh.
And so what he did is he chased the leader into the woods, and he ended up killing him. And then he looked in his pocket, and there was a business card in his pocket for a New York restaurant, which he learned later was a non-existing restaurant. And there was a 202 telephone number on the back of the card. And so the next day he called.
Is this the man that had shot the satanic ritual people? Is this what you're saying here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the same one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next day He interrupted a human sacrifice satanic ceremony is what he did.
Okay.
So the next day, this is what I was telling you about before I was interrupted. So the next day, he called this 202 number, which is a Washington, D.C. number, and a woman, female voice, said Federal Bureau of Investigation. And during the, he was chasing this leader through the woods, he said that we have the FBI and the police in our pocket, and he told this my John Van Meter, my friend, who later developed a friendship with him, that if he kills him, he will live in a 10-by-10 cell the rest of his life, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that was the girl was rescued. He put her in the car, and he told her to take off. She took off, and she had been kidnapped the day before in a parking lot out of Oakland, California. So anyway, so the police were notified of this shooting, and they waited 4 days to go to the crime scene, which gave somebody a chance to clean it up. And then they said that John Van Meter did not commit a crime. He filed a fake and false report. And so they filed charges on him for filing a false report. Now, this is very important that you understand this, because this shows the depth of the infiltration right down to the local police department. And that we're talking about the Illuminati. They've infiltrated every level of society. So they charged John with filing a false report, and his attorney, he was in Wisconsin now in the meantime. This is in Sonoma County, which is right outside of San Francisco, about 50, 60 miles north of San Francisco. And his attorney told him, he said, don't come back here, because if you come back here for a trial, you will go to jail. You will spend time in jail. And so he made an agreement to plead out, and copped the plea, and he was given 2 years probation and a $10,000 fine. He never even bothered to show up back in California. Now, and by the way, he was shot 4 times, once with a shotgun and then 3 different 9mm pistols in California. Now,
that was during the while he was trying to rescue the girl.
Yes,
okay.
When he rescued the girl, chased and shot four of them, and then chased the leader into the woods.
And let me make sure that I followed you correctly here because of the interruption. So the guy that he got a hold, that the fifth one, he didn't shoot because he was threatened. Is that what you're saying now?
No, the fifth one fled in. The leader was the fifth one. He fled into the woods.
Okay, all right.
And John followed him into the woods and ended up chasing him down, shooting him.
Oh, okay.
But the significance of this is that the locals did not want this information to get out. So in order to prevent it from getting out to the public, which would make headlines, they said he filed a false report. But that's not the end of the report. That's not the end of the incident, I should say. Because a year and a half later, April the 19th, 2006. Now, that April 19th, by the way, is
a significant date. Yes,
significant date. Right. That's Oklahoma City. That's Waco. That's Adolf Hitler's birthday. April 19th, and April 20th. It's long in there. So, April 19th of 2006. He's in Wisconsin, and he notices he's under surveillance. He goes into the woods, and he hides behind some heavy-duty equipment that he had for chopping down trees. And these two fellows came in behind him in a car, and he recognized them from the California shootout. And he had the gun battle there. He knocked one of them down 4 times. He knocked the other one down 2x. And they finally had enough, and they jumped in the car and took off. Now, in Wisconsin, he was shot 5 times with 2 different weapons and a .223 rifle and 9mm pistol. Or a .380, he wasn't sure which. And the authorities in Wisconsin, he reported to them, and they said that he filed a false report. He had his car there that had 22 or 23 bullet holes in it, his pickup truck. And so the authorities there in Wisconsin and authorities in California said this is all false information. And they ended up saying that he shot himself. Now, he was shot 9 times with 6 different weapons.
He must look like Swiss cheese by now with all these bullet wounds.
Well, he was fortunate to live. And as a matter of fact, he started down the road, down the highway, from the wooded area, and fortunately was an isolated area. Fortunately, a man came down and picked him up and took him to the hospital. But in Sonoma County, California, he was charged with false report and fined $10,000, and also $120 finance fee. And then 1 year on court probation. In Wisconsin, he was charged with obstruction of justice, 2 counts. And he was given a $2,500 fine, 1 year probation, and 14 days in jail after a jury trial. He had a jury trial in Wisconsin. And, authorities, his defense attorney in Wisconsin brought in a specialist on weapons, guns, and this specialist said it was not possible for him to have shot himself. There was no gun residue on him. So there's your story, this case, and of course he ended up, fortunately he only had 14 days in jail. Now, but it shows that there's a cover-up in Wisconsin, a cover-up in Sonoma County, California. Now he's on probation, and they continuously raided his home looking for weapons, alcohol, and what have you, because if they found any weapons or alcohol while you're on probation, he can go straight to jail. And also, he noticed that somebody had planted a marijuana plant in his garden. So if they'd found a marijuana plant in his garden, they would have been able to put him in jail also. So that just shows you the extent. And I attended the trial. I was going to testify, but his attorney said all I would do was muddy the water because I was going to bring in the fact that there is a national satanic cult operation. By the way, the restaurant on the card was Gaither, G-A-R-I-Urinther, Greek restaurant, at 461 Embark Street, New York City. Phone number was the main number on there. Also was for, there were two numbers in addition to the FBI number. There was a number to Chase Manhattan Bank, it was a 212 number.
Okay, now where did he find this card at?
This is on the body of the leader that he shot and killed.
Okay, all right.
And so in Sonoma County, the police threatened him, 5 counts of murder and 2 counts of attempted murder, so forth. And this, there was a 4-day, as I said, there was a 4-day delay before they went out and searched the area. And the leader, when he was chasing him through the woods, said, I have a get-out-of-jail-free. And we own the police here and the FBI. The leader was about in his early 20s, 6'1", 160, white male, dark hair, long hair, long beard, mustache, black, left-handed, and so on and so forth. Anyway, that was kind of an interesting case. But the most important factor here is that in both counties, in Lincoln County, Wisconsin, and Sonoma County, California, this was covered up. And rather than admit that it happened, they prosecuted him, which shows, again, the infiltration of the Illuminati and the satanic cults into our society.
Now, when you're talking about the place that in Sonoma County, is that near kind of like where Bohemian Grove would be?
Yes, it's the same county.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Same county, huh?
And so what does he think about what was going on? What is his what does your client think about what was going on? What's his feelings?
Well, he knows what's going on. He knows that this is a cover up at the highest levels of our lowest and highest levels of our government.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the more interesting cases that I worked recently, and of course you mentioned the Nebraska Franklin cover-up case, which I worked back in the 1980s with John McCamp, who's one of my heroes. He wrote the book, The Franklin Cover-Up. And the Franklin cover-up on the Nebraska case is available to your listening audience, along with some of my other material on the website.
Okay. And what? Give us your side of what you did and what was involved with that, the Franklin cover-up.
Well, I was... there was a fellow named Ed Weaver in Lincoln, Nebraska, who owned the potato chip factory. And he, and by the way, Lincoln, Nebraska is my hometown. And he read about a Ted Gunderson in the book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, a book about the Son of Sam murders in New York City. And he called me, and he said, are you the same Ted Gunderson from Lincoln, Nebraska? He and I were in high school together in college, and I said, yeah, that's me. He said, well, I'm running, I have an organization called the Nebraska Leadership Conference, and we are civilians who are investigating the allegations concerning the Franklin cover-up case, along with a state congressional committee headed up by Lauren Schmidt and John DeCamp.
And the name of the person that you're talking to, say, I mean, you refer
was Ed Weaver.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Ed Weaver. And he recognized my name in the book, called me, and said, we need you to come back and work with us. So he paid my way back, and I went back and did some work on the case and so forth. And what happened in the Nebraska Franklin cover-up case was that children who claimed that they were exposed and part of at least as participants, satanic ritual abuse and satanic cult and human sacrifices and so forth. They were taken out of orphanages, Boys Town, and foster homes, and driven from Omaha, Nebraska to Sioux City, Iowa, 184 miles away. And then they were flown in private jets to Washington, D.C., for sex orgies with congressmen, senators, dignitaries, and what have you. And this book by John DeCamp is one of the most important books of the whole century, as far as I'm concerned, because this exposes them for what they're doing and what they've done. And, of course, then at that point, they can turn right around and tell the congressmen and senators how to vote. And I have a five-hour interview with one of the kids who was involved with this Franklin cover-up network. And they were also used, these kids, 10, 12, 13 years old, as decoys in parks and shopping malls to track other children over their same age. And then the adults would grab the victims, the other kids they tracked that they brought over through attraction, and put them in the back of a car and be off with them. They were kidnapping kids, using these kids as I said, as decoys to bring over to that near the vicinity of the automobile. But I have a five-hour interview with Paul Benassi, who, when he was 15 years old, he was used as one of those decoys that involved in the kidnappings. And this is on YouTube. This is my interview with Paul. I've been told that. And I went back there, and in addition to interviewing Paul Benassi, I interviewed a fellow named Rusty Nelson. Rusty Nelson was the official photographer of the group when they were in Washington, D.C., and he would be the guy that would take the pictures of the congressmen, senators, and dignitaries in compromising positions with children, and they'd use these pictures to blackmail them and tell them how to vote, as I said a few moments ago. Now, what happened with Rusty is he was very clever in that, in addition to putting their film into his camera, he, on occasion, would put his own film into the camera, and he took pictures and smuggled them out himself, knowing that was his life insurance policy. He was smart enough to do that. And so that was Rusty's savior, as a matter of fact. He's still alive today, last time I heard. And he was propositioned for a sexual act by a man, and he didn't want to do it and didn't want to get involved in that phase of it. And went out a motel bathroom window and made his way back to Nebraska. He was a farm kid, and so he went into hiding. And then sometime later, FBI agents came to his parents' home looking for Rusty. And the mother made the mistake of telling the FBI agents where Rusty was staying. Rusty was staying at his grandfather's farm. Grandfather had passed on, and he was living there alone in the farmhouse, and the FBI interviewed Rusty at his father's grandpa's home. And then Rusty took off, of course, and he made his way across country in a hearse, an old beat-up hearse, and he made his living by washing windows in small towns. He'd go into a store and say, for $15, I'll wash your window. And, of course, they would say, okay, that's fine. And then he was in Portland, Oregon. And the police caught up with him there, and they said he had a broken taillight. They arrested him, put him in jail. And but before he did that, before they arrested him, Rusty scattered these pictures around the country, placed them in different locations. And I waited for him to get out of jail. And when he got out of jail, I went up to Oregon. I contacted him. And I said, come on, Rusty, let's go find the pictures. Well, he told me where they were. We found an abandoned house in Oregon. They were not there anymore. Then we went, according to him. And then we went to an abandoned mining mill in Colorado. And they were not there. He hid them in the basement of the mining mill. Instead of the pictures, there was a dynamite cap in place. And then he said he had some pictures up in the mountains. And so I couldn't make it up into the mountains, about a mile up the mountain. And but I stayed down below, and he went up there, and the pictures were gone. So I said to Rusty, you're telling me that you have these pictures. We also, and then he also said he had pictures in an old abandoned car in New Mexico. So we drove down to New Mexico. This is over a period of about 2.5 months, by the way. And we couldn't find the pictures in the car. So I said, Rusty, you're telling me you had these pictures. What happened to him? He said, well, while I was in jail in Portland, men in suits came in and talked to me, and he thinks that he is a mind control victim. He's got multiple personalities, and he thinks that he told him the location of these pictures and they went out ahead of him. Now, I think that he's got pictures stashed that he didn't tell me about, and so I think that's what's kept Rusty alive. But it's that's basically, now, the way this case broke was the IRS and the FBI. There's $40 million missing in the Franklin Savings and Loan, which was a savings loan in a minority neighborhood for use for minorities. And there was publicity. There were pictures in the paper. And some of the kids said, Mommy, that man molested me. And there are pictures of another Larry King. And so on and so forth. That's how the case broke. And from there on, there was a big investigation by the state Senate committee, as I said, and also by the Nebraska Leadership Conference. But that basically is the Nebraska case in a nutshell.
Well, so how did you come across Rusty again for this?
Well, I heard that he was are you there?
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm hearing a beep like your battery's going low.
Oh, boy. No, I heard that he was in jail, and I waited for him to get out. And then when he got out, I ran him down, I've got another interruption here, so you go ahead and talk to him while I'll be back.
Okay. All right, well, Ted has been involved in a number of investigations, and some of them, I believe, oh my goodness, I know he was involved with the Oklahoma City investigation, and but this Franklin cover-up, if you want to go to his website, it's tedgunderson.net. And there also is a number of YouTube videos on there that has his story and the various investigations that he's been involved with, and it's this why I'm kind of focusing in on this particular case of the Franklin cover-up is because these sort of things are. It can happen to any of our children, and the people that do get caught up in it are unable to get out of it, and it goes up to the highest people, not only in this country but around the internationally, and I'm finding that if we don't start paying attention to some of these drug investigations or the criminality, the corruption that's going on, it if people would start standing up and making a difference with one avenue, you're going to start finding out it ties into everything. It ties into the politics. It ties in the economics. It ties into every aspect of our lives. And until we start looking at this and start addressing it, not sweeping it under the rug, then we might stand a chance, or it's going to overtake, or has overtaken all our lives, whether we want to admit it or not. Are you back, Ted?
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. There's another interesting case that I worked back in the late 1980s, early 90s, and it's the McMartin preschool case out of Manhattan Beach, California.
Right, right.
And are you familiar with that case?
Yes, and do go on about it.
Yeah, and what happened is this is a preschool for preschool children, ages 2, 3, 4, up to 5. And one of the little boys came home, and the mother noticed diapers, blood in the diapers, and she started talking to him, and he said that he'd been molested, sexually molested, and so she made a big issue out of it. Long story short, there are other children that came forward, and the therapist interviewed the kids before the police interviewed them, and there was a claim then that the therapist planted the information on the children. And the children talked about satanic, what they didn't know, but there was adults in robes with candles chanting in an underground chamber under the school. The children also talked about tunnels.
Okay, do you want to, okay, before you get further, just kind of explain where this was at and what all, you know.
This was Manhattan Beach, California.
Okay.
It's a very affluent area of the city of Los Angeles, right outside of part of Los Angeles County, and right on the ocean. So people have, you know, multi-million-dollar homes there. And so the children said that there were tunnels under the school, and the authority went out in 1987, as I recall, and said that they looked for the tunnels and couldn't find them. Well, they had a trial. And in the trial, they tried Ray Buckey, the son, and the grandmother, who owned the school. And the grandmother was acquitted, and they had a hung jury on Ray Buckey. So they had a second trial. And during the second trial, I learned that the school had been given from the McMartin family to Danny Davis for the first trial. Danny Davis had sold it and to a contractor, and he was going to tear down the school and put an office building there. So I went to the contractor and said, let me get on this property for 2 weeks. So I signed legal papers, assumed liability. I had a friend of mine who was an attorney. I dropped the papers and hired an archaeologist, Dr. Gary Stickle. And within 2 weeks, as a matter of fact, it was more than 2 weeks, it was 34 days after we began excavation. We announced that there had been tunnels under the school that had been filled in. The children said that the tunnel entrance to the tunnel was on the side outside of classroom number 4. And so we took a backhoe and went straight down the wall of classroom number 4, and about a foot below the foundation of the building was a plastic sandwich bag. And it had apparently flown in there when somebody filled in the tunnels. The tunnels were filled in with foreign soil. I'm not familiar in that area. And this sandwich bag said Disney sandwich bag, and it was dated 1982. It was as if God had put it there. And so that was, we feel, that was the date, and that was about the time that the case broke. 1982. That was the date that they filled in the tunnels. And the reason the archaeologist said that there had been tunnels there that were filled in is because if you go straight down like slicing a loaf of bread, you can see the difference in the soil where the tunnels were filled in and where they had not been filled in, the sides of the tunnels and so forth. But the children said that they were taken through these tunnels up into the trap door of the bathroom and the triplex next door taken out into the community and prostituted. 2-, 3-, 4-year-old children prostituted. So anyway, in the second trial, is right in the middle of the second trial, as I said, I notified the district attorney that we had located tunnels that had been filled in under the school, and she could use them in the trial. She didn't bother to use them. She sent an investigator out named Perez, who said he wanted to argue with Dr. Stickle that there were no tunnels in the school at all. Also, the children said that they were taken in by airplane up into the mountains. Well, a short distance from the McMartin preschool is the airport, Hawthorne Airport. And the McMartins had a very close friend who owned a jet. And so we think that the kids were flown up there out of Hawthorne Airport. And I located the location where the kids were taken in Crestline, which is in the mountains, about 100 miles by air out of Los Angeles. And it was built on the side of the mountain. It was a massive structure. And about the length of about probably 80 or 90 yards. And you could only see it from the air. You couldn't see it from the street because it was down over the crest of the hill. And the house on that property, after the little boy, the mother went public with a little boy who had blood in his diapers. The day after that happened, the house burned down. Hmm. And so this was, and I went up there and took pictures and had all kinds of pictures of this, of the site. And I called Lael Rubin, the prosecutor, personally talked to her and said that I think I know where the kids were taken. Would you be interested? And she was not interested. So another cover-up. Now, why would they cover up the McMartin preschool case? Because the children identified actors, professional baseball player, professional football player, and it goes on, and prominent politicians and so forth. So another huge cover-up.
Okay, now, how many kids do you think were involved in this?
Well, there had we did the research on the number of kids who had gone through the McMartin preschool, and there were like 5,500 children over a period of years. The school was built back in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1980s, of course. This is 20 years afterwards.
But now, the same people didn't own this school, did they?
They owned it from the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, they built it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what makes you, why do you think they were able to keep the kids quiet about it for so long?
Well, that's a good question, because I knew for a fact that one of the children who attended the school, what they did is they went to her home, and the mother and father were not there. The mother and father were they dropped the kid off in the morning, took him up in the afternoon. And they took the little kitty cat, the little girl's cat, took the cat back to the school and sacrificed it, and told the girl if she talked to her mother, they would do this to her brother, and so she was scared to death. So she didn't talk. And that was one of the techniques they used to keep the kids quiet.
Do you think they used mind control techniques with them?
Well, that's part of mind control, yes. I would say so. Uh-huh.
Okay. I mean, because I would find that if you had that many, unless they just had select few that they worked with in the middle of all of this, or...
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know how many were victims, but I'm sure that most, if not all of them, were victims. But they threatened them. And we're talking about little children, 2-, 3-, 4-year-old children. They're very impressionable.
Have any of them ever come forward later on? Since then?
I don't know if they have or not, but I know that we found there were tunnels under the school, and the kids that came forward initially were telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. And how many did you say there were involved that did come forward?
I don't have that count, but there was quite a few, several. Not probably 8, 15, 20, 30, whatever.
Okay, all right.
But the authorities, the defense claimed that the information was planted in the minds by the therapists, because they went to therapy. And then the priest came along afterwards and took statements and so forth. But it was definitely a big cover-up. So
how far along in the investigation, or how far along had this gone along before you got involved in the investigation of this?
How far along am I?
How soon did you get involved in the
investigation? Well, I got involved in this case in 1989-90.
Okay, so this was quite a while.
9 years, 10 years, 8 years later, okay. When they had the trial and so forth, yeah.
Okay, all right.
And the school had been shut down, of course, and I went in and hired the archaeology team, Dr. Gary Stick and his men from UCLA, and we had concrete cutters, cut concrete. We had laborers that dug, and it was a big excavation for us. I personally invested $17,000 of my own money, and the whole project cost about $55,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you really
people donated help. Money, and fortunately, like the people that were they cut the concrete, they donated their time, didn't charge us. But it was quite an operation. I have pictures. By the way, all these cases I'm telling you about are on a CD that I sell, and like the scientific report on the McMartin Tunnel dig and Oklahoma City also, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a report on 911. I do these investigations on my own. And you can get a copy of this CD, folks, by sending me $35.
Okay, now we can't talk about prices on we can say
I can't? Okay.
Okay, so we can just, you know, tell people how to get
it. They can get it through my website, the CD.
Okay, and so as far as, are there other kind of cases that tie in around this? I mean, because obviously if you got to be known for investigating one type of case, you probably got others that kind of came forth.
Well, I had the Van Meter case, the McMartin case, the Nebraska Franklin cover-up case. Those are the big ones. And then I've had other, I've interviewed a number of people. Like, for example, I interviewed a fellow named Peter Chernev. He was up in Santa Rosa again. And Peter was a mind control victim. So I've interviewed a number of these people who were involved in these type of activities.
Okay, what about Noreen Gosh?
And, of course, Noreen Gosh, Johnny Gosh, was a victim of the Franklin cover-up case. And, as a matter of fact, Paul Benassi, who I mentioned a few moments ago, was in on the kidnapping of Johnny Gosh in West Des Moines, Iowa. And Johnny Gosh was taken to a holding house in Sioux City, Iowa, and then flown from there to a place in Colorado. And they did a story, I think it was Unsolved Mysteries, did about a five-part series on the case. And they filmed the place in Colorado, and somebody came into Noreen Gosh's house and stole. They didn't come in. Her husband, ex-husband, came in and took all the shows of Unsolved Mysteries of that case. And so she's never been able to recover them. And she's gone to Unsolved Mysteries people, and they have not cooperated with her. So this thing, the tentacles of the satanic cult. The network works very high up into our government and into our society.
So you're saying the guy that started that Unsolved Mysteries, I was thinking of something else, another
program. America's Most Wanted. John Adams.
Okay. So he never got involved in anything along the...
Well, he's been involved in these cases. Unsolved Mysteries or America's Most... I think he's Unsolved Mysteries. No.
No, he's America.
He's America's Most Wanted. Yeah.
I think so, right.
Yeah, and I think they were the ones that did the story on the Franklin cover-up and on the Johnny Gosh. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Noreen Gosh has a book out. I think it's out of print now, called Why Johnny Can't Come Home. I sold quite a few of them on my website.
Uh-huh. And so as far as how involved were you involved in the middle of this investigation, or is this just it is tied in with the Franklin cover up, or is that kind of an extraneous part of it?
Which case you mean?
Johnny Gosh.
Well, yeah, it is. Yeah, it was part of the Franklin cover-up case.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. See, because Paul DeMasi, who, as I say, I interviewed him for 5 hours, and it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
My interview with him is on YouTube. He was one of the kids in that helped kidnap Johnny Gosch, and Paul was used as a decoy to kidnap other children. And Paul was a first-hand witness to this case.
Why don't you get into that a little bit? You know, because with my interviews, I haven't really gotten a chance to really get more in depth with what happened with Paul Bonacci.
Yeah, well, Paul, what happened is I went back, and I think this was 1993, flew into Nebraska specifically to debrief Paul Bonacci. I was going to spend probably 12, 14 hours with him. And I was only able to spend 5 hours with him, unfortunately, because my mother was very ill and she was passing on. And so I had to leave right after I did this five-hour interview.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular interview, Paul, are you there?
Yeah, but you're fading in out. Well, we'll have to try to get him back here. And hopefully that will be able to call back in. This isn't uncommon, I see. So I'll go ahead and put some music on here, and while we try to get reconnected. Some guitar music that's with my often co-host, Dr. Carlstrom, but I think I've got Ted back. Are you there? Ted?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, good. So,
can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's see if I don't get over-modulated here. Sometimes the change in the phones and stuff can affect it. We were talking about Paul Bonacci. So, and let me go ahead and say that the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests. Do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And while I'm at it, let's say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I've got with me Ted Gunderson, and we're getting into some of the cases around child abduction many other aspects that go along with it. So, and right now we're talking about Paul Bonacci that was involved with the Franklin cover-up. So, go ahead, Ted.
I'm here, but you're breaking up. But but anyway, Paul is an interesting fellow, and of course, since he's gone public, he's had security problems, as all of us do who are involved in these type of activities. And he got married, straightened out his life, and has a child or one or two children now. And so he's not been vocal of recent years, but he was brave enough to come forward initially. And the initial investigation of the Franklin cover-up case, the 80 children who came forward, there were four who were willing to testify, Paul Bonacci, Troy Bonner, and Alicia Owen. And there was a fourth one, I forget his name offhand. He disappeared. I don't know if, I hope nothing harmful happened to him. And the authorities came after all three of those kids and threatened them if they testified.
Okay, let me let you go ahead and continue to talk. I have to go check on some levels here, so just go ahead and keep talking about that.
Sure.
Okay.
And that's basically Troy Bonner ended up
He died in a hospital. Paul Benassi was tried for child molestation. So, of course, that's one of the techniques that the Illuminati uses, Satanists use, to discredit him. And Alicia Owens, they tried her for lying to the grand jury, because when she went before the grand jury on the Franklin cover-up case, she said that the chief of police, Bob Wadman, had sex with her when she was 14 years old. And so in order to discredit her, they tried her, and I attended one day of the trial and said that she lied, and she was tried and convicted and spent more time, went to the penitentiary and spent more time in solitary confinement than any woman in the history of the state of Nebraska. But the significant factor here, folks, is look at these cases that I'm reviewing with you. In every instance, the Van Meter case, the McMartin case, the Franklin cover-up case, every instance there's cover-up itself. And the authorities, this shows again the extent of the infiltration into our society and how they can control cases from the ground level up. And in the Van Meter case, they said he shot himself, and he was shot 9 times with 6 different weapons, which is absolutely preposterous. And in the Franklin cover-up case, nobody was ever brought to justice, even though they were involved. It was involved in the international child kidnapping ring. The Finders, which was a case out of Tallahassee, Florida, in that case, the two men, well-dressed men, and they were in a park with 6 young children, ages 2 to 6, and 2 to 5, I think it was. And the police were called, and they showed up in the park, and the children were shabbily dressed. They didn't know anything about telephones, how to use telephones, how to use toilets, and they said that they were en route to Mexico to a smart school. And so the police ended up, found out that the men were from Washington, D.C. They had Virginia plates on the car. And, so they, notified the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. And, Washington, D.C. Police Department went out with search warrants at the school where these kids came from. And it was called the Finders School. And they found all kinds of unusual information and details about what was going on in the school. And it was very revealing. And if you'll give me just a few minutes, I'll get a report out. And by the way, my reports are available on this CD. It's on the Internet. And including Oklahoma City and all these other reports. And this is the report I'm talking about now, is the Finders report. And they found out that these kids were belong to this organization out of Washington, D.C. called the Finders. And so in this raid that by the police, they discovered that there was what appeared to be satanic type ceremonies had taken place there, the children, there were pictures of children involved in what appeared to be the satanic ceremonies. And so anyway, this is another instance of a cover-up, and nothing ever came of that. The Metropolitan Police ended up with information about I've got a report here that on this Finders case. I'll just go over it with you very briefly.
And you were involved in this particular case as well.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, and did you work with Jim Rothstein any of this? I mean,
I know Jim. He worked with Noreen Gosh, I know. On the Johnny Gosch case, yeah.
Okay.
I work with Jim. I know who he is, of course.
Right.
But the report here that what happened is in this report, the finders, the U.S. Customs was notified by the Metropolitan Police Department because they thought there might be interstate pornography involved. And so this investigator for the U.S. Customs went down to the Metropolitan Police Department. By the way, the Tallahassee Police Department checked these kids out on February the 5th, 1987. And they were, as I said, there were two adults and there were six minor children. And the adults' names were Bob Harrell out of Reston, Virginia. Excuse me, that's not one. That was one of the agents involved in it. He wasn't. Anyway, I've got this customs report in front of me right now.
Well, Ted, let me ask you something. When you were while you were working with the FBI, did you feel like that you were running across things that were hidden or covered up when you worked with them, or were they kind of taken out of your hands, or just kind of, you know?
I didn't see anything of that.
And so, it's kind of a group that operates within the organization. Do you think, or
no? It's what we have. What I think we have is a covert rogue element that's infiltrated into the various intelligence agencies. And by the way, looking at this, let me just read this last page of this U.S. Customs report. He was contact with the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. And here's what he said. You know, on March 31, 1987, I contacted Detective James Bradley, the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, MPD. I was to meet with Detective Bradley to review the documents seized pursuant to two search warrants executed in February 1987. The meeting was to take place on April 2nd or 3rd, 1987. On April 2nd, 1987, I arrived at the Metropolitan Police Department at approximately 9 a.m. Detective Bradley was not available. I spoke to a third party who was willing to discuss the case with me on a strictly, quote, off-the-record, end quote, basis. I was advised that all passport data had been turned over to the State Department for their investigation. In the van in Tallahassee, Florida, the police found two passports of the adults. The State Department in turn advised the Metropolitan Police Department that all travel and use of the passports by the holders of the passports was within the law and no action would be taken. This included travel to Moscow, North Korea, and North Vietnam from the late 1950s to mid-1970s. Now, it was illegal for us to travel in those countries at that time, by the way. The individual further advised me of
So those people have been at it a long time, or do you think they were utilizing passing that passport back and forth with different people?
Oh, no, they were. This was a long-time investigation, long-time operation.
Okay.
This is international trafficking of children is what it boils down to.
Right. Keep going.
The individual further advised me of circumstances which indicated that the investigation into the activity of the finders had become a CI internal matter. So it became a CI internal matter. Now, what does that mean? Well, you and I know that if somebody's going to investigate it internally, that means it's part of their organization. The Metropolitan Police Department report had been classified secret and was not available for review. I was advised that the FBI withdrawn from the investigation several weeks prior and that the FBI Foreign Counterintelligence Division had directed the Metropolitan Police Department not to advise the FBI Washington Field Office of anything that had transpired. No further information will be available. No further action will be taken. And then that was it. That's the end of the customs report. So
this is an international thing. And what do they get for these kids when they start, you know, trading them on an international basis?
Paul Benassi told me that he's attended six auctions where the kids were auctioned off, and as many as 36 and as few as six were at these auctions. And they auction off for about up to $50,000 each.
What happens to these kids once they're picked up and taken? Why is it so hard for them to get back to the parents? I mean, this is one of the things that kind of comes out.
Well, the kids end up being some of them sacrificed, used for sex, used for pornography. Some of them are actually adopted. in the rich families overseas. But, you know, if you're a 2-, 3-, 4-year-old child and you place in the hands of an adult later in life, you don't know if that's your father or not, or if that's your mother.
And a lot of times, is it not true that when they're that young that they repress memories of these incidents?
I'd say so, yes.
Right, and it also can cause, like, it's used as a technique that can create multiple personalities where they don't even remember. I mean,
absolutely, MK Ultra mind. They call MK Ultra. Yeah.
Right. And that they seem to like to pick them at a certain age as well. Now, do you think many of them get in, so you're saying some of them get sacrificed, so they get into these occult sacrificial groups, and how prevalent do you think that is?
Yeah, well, you're breaking up, by the way.
Hope
I'm not breaking up.
You're not breaking up, but I don't, you know, how much do you think, how prevalent do you think the occult is?
Very common, very prevalent. It's been concealed and secretly operates throughout the United States. I estimate about 1.5% of the population is involved in these type of activities, Illuminati.
You think it's that big, huh?
Yeah. I'll tell you why, because one of my informants in South Central Los Angeles, which is where the McMartin case was, told me that there's about 3,000 in that area. 3,000 active members, that's a population of 200,000. And Lincoln, Nebraska, at that time, this is quite a few years ago, the population 200,000. Another source told me about 3,000 members were there. And in Iowa City, Iowa, a third source told me that there's about 1,500 there. So if you project those figures on a percentage basis, it's about 1.5% of the population, which is quite a few million people. So, and it's huge. It's covered up. By the way, on the finders, there was an article for good documentation, U.S. News through a glass, very darkly. It's an article, U.S. News World Report, December 27, 1993, January 3rd, 1994. And it went out, it went out publicly, of course, and it was announced publicly in U.S. News and World Report. And it talks about the pickup of the children, the two well-dressed men, in Tallahassee, and they about the raid, and none of the allegations were ever proven. However, they claim this: a child abuse charge against two men in Tallahassee were dropped. All six of the children were eventually returned to their mothers, though in the case of two, conditions were attached by a court. In Washington, D.C., police began backing away from the finder's investigation. The roof practice, the police said, was eccentric and not illegal. Questions. Today, things appear to have changed yet again. The Justice Department began a new investigation of the finders and its group's activities. It is also reviewing the 1987 investigation of the group to determine whether the probe was closed improperly. Justice officials would not elaborate experts to say the investigation is ongoing. It involves unsolved matters in relation to the finders. One of the unsolved questions involves allegations that the finders are somehow linked to the Central Intelligence Agency. Customs Service document revealed, that's the one that I have, the document I have. But by the way, that's available through the CD on my website.
Okay.
I have 6,500 pages, 52 reports available on my CD. And on this CD that's available on my website. Customs Service documents revealed that in 1987, when customs agents sought to examine the evidence gathered in Washington, D.C. police, they were told that the findings of investigation had become a CIA internal matter. The police report in this case had been classified secret. Even now, Tallahassee police complain that the handling of the finder's investigation in Washington, D.C., quote, they dropped this case, end quote. One Tallahassee investigator says, like a hot rock, end quote. D.C. police will not comment on the matter. As for the CIA, ranking officials describe allegations about links between the agency and the finders as hogwash. Perhaps the result of a simple mix-up with D.C. police. The only connection, according to the CIA, a firm that provided computer training to CIA officials who also employed several members of the finders. The nasty correction. The many unanswered questions about the finders case now have Democratic Representative Charles Rose of North Carolina, Chairman of the House Administration Committee, and Florida's Representative Tom Lewis, a Republican, more than a little exercise, quote, could our own government have something to do with this finders organization and turn their backs on these children? That's what all the evidence points to, says Lewis. Quote, and there's a lot of evidence. I can tell you this. We've got a lot of people scrambling, and it wouldn't be happening if there was nothing here. Paragraph, perhaps. But the finders say there's nothing there, at least nothing illegal. The finders have never been involved in child abuse, pornography, Satanism, animal slaughtery, or anything of that kind. By the way, they found pictures of the children of the satanic ceremony and the sacrifice of animals and so forth in the finder's report by the customs agent. And anyway, going on with this article, Satanism, animal slaughter, anything of that kind, says the group's leader, Marion Davis Petty. Petty, too, says the group has never been connected to the CIA. In an interview with U.S. News, Petty described the finders as a communal, holistic living and learning arrangement. The group members, some 20 members, Petty says, they do freelance journalism research and competitor intelligence for a variety of mostly foreign clients. By the way, they had, I might mention also that they had, in this finder's report by the customs agent, they had ties all over the world. And they talked about children being shipped all over the world. The finders work for no foreign government, Petty says. They're in their duplex in a residential northeast Washington neighborhood is decorated with global maps and bulletin boards. Residents of Culpeper, Virginia, 90 miles from Washington, say the finders have occupied an office there, too, from time to time. The office contains computer terminals and clocks reflecting different time zones around the world. CIA officials say they referred to all matters concerning the finders and the police investigated to the FBI's counterintelligence division. FBI officials will not comment. Law enforcement sources say some of the finders are listed in the FBI's classified counterintelligence files. None of this phases Petty. He says the CIA's interest in the finders may stem from the fact that his late wife once worked for the agency and his son worked for a CIA proprietary firm, Air America. Overall, says Petty, we're a zero security threat. When you don't have when you don't do much of anything, and you don't explain, people start rumors about you. End quote. To judge from the latest case, some of the rumors, at least, are awfully long time, an awful long time. Now, I went to Washington D.C. here several years ago, and I attempted to locate Representative Charles Rose of North Carolina, who was mentioned as chairman of the House Administration Committee, and Florida's Representative Tom Lewis, a Republican, they're no longer in office, so it's kind of interesting, too. And by the way, speaking of that, I might mention that they control, they meaning this rogue element controls, the election of individuals through the electronic voting machines. So...
Well, don't they use?
I have furnished my report to the FBI about the finders on six occasions, and they won't even bother to come on and interview me. And is there some kind of interesting also I might mention? The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They claim that there's 91 Americans disappear every hour, and 85 to 90% are believed to be children. And so I have these cards that they pass out through the mail with the children's pictures on them and where they advertise that they found so many kids and all that sort of thing. I had like 94 of them, and I charted the number of children that disappeared during certain months. And the months of January... 4, February 6, March 3, April 3, May 4, June 18, July 8, August 9, September 3, October 15, November 7, December 14. Now, did you pick up those figures?
Okay, now are those significant dates for rituals?
Yes.
Okay.
Where 18 kids were missing, according to the National Center and Missing Exploited. That's the summer solstice. June the 21st. October is Halloween. October 31st, another satanic holiday. And December, where there are 14 missing, is of course, that's the winter solstice. And this is just a small fraction of the missing children in the United States. The statistics illustrate the high percentage of missing children in those 3 months. The months are three of the major satanic holidays. For example, June, the solstice, two times a year the sun has no apparent northward or southward motion. And of course, October 31st is Halloween, which is celebrate the dead. And December the 20th is Christmas. Individuals, personal birthdays. So I think that's rather significant and very interesting as far as I'm concerned.
Now, one of the things, do you run across other investigators from other countries looking into this?
No, I haven't. I've never run across any other investigators from other countries.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I know that they had some satanic ceremonies were exposed in Belgium here about 8 or 9, 10 years ago. And there was they found some children in a dungeon or in a cage in the basement of a building, and they tied it into the satanic ceremony. And so I don't know what's happening around the world. I know one thing, it's being covered up here in the United States, big time.
Well, I've been doing some reading with some of the work that Alex Constantine had done on some of this, and he was bringing up a lot going on in Argentina and with something, a group called like the Children of God. Have you heard of them or the family?
I've heard of them. Yeah, Alex Constantine you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah, I know Alex. I haven't talked to him in years. I don't know if he's... somebody told me he disappeared on us. I hope not. But he was a very wonderful fellow, and I know he's done a number of books on it.
Uh-huh. And so while we're at it, you know, I mean, there's just so much to... I mean, there's a... You know, they can go to your website and get a lot of information on this, because this is something that's prevalent, like I said.
Well, as I said, I have this CD that has 52 reports, including this finder's report, and it's a total of 6,500 pages on this CD that is available to the public. So
now, now, I was listening to one of the interviews you had on the net. That's something you did back in about 2008. And you had spoken of somebody named Malcolm that was working with you. Were you able to ever do anything, help this particular person out? Or?
Oh, yes, yes. This was what happened with Malcolm. Malcolm, my first webmaster was murdered. And my second webmaster was set up and framed on a child molestation case. I can say that with certainty because I personally reviewed the reports of all the kids that they claimed he molested, and not one of those kids said he ever touched them. But they manipulated the court, and I think they had a plant on the jury, to be honest with you. And Malcolm is my third webmaster, and he and I and his wife, Linda, and the little girl, Anna, all lived together. She was, right now she's 10 years old. And we lived together for about 2 years. And Malcolm was living with, before we lived together in Nebraska, Malcolm and I worked together in Las Vegas, Nevada. And he stayed at my place after there was an apparent kidnapping attempt of him. And that's kind of an interesting story, too. I was in... going through Sam's Club line to pay for some groceries and other things, and I had a call from Malcolm. He said, Ted, get over here right away. And so I jumped in my car and drove over to where Malcolm, he lived some distance away from there. And he met me, came up and met me. He said that he had gone out into his van. He was going to go to the store, and all of a sudden, he noticed there was a helicopter, black helicopter, over him, hovering over him. And then he saw a number of cars going back and forth on the street. He felt like he was under surveillance. And so I drove on over to see what was going on. And within two blocks of the neighborhood, within two blocks of the Malcolm's home in the neighborhood, I had tight surveillance on me. He wasn't even discreet. And I did a U-turn, and this fellow did a U-turn. I did another U-turn. He did a U-turn. It was very obvious he was trailing me. And so I pulled up alongside of him with my window down. His window was down. And he brandished a gun and said, "This is my effing neighborhood. Get out of my effing neighborhood." And so I didn't have a gun, so I took off. And I run through the residential area of Las Vegas. And I did a cell phone call to Malcolm. I said, "Call the police." And I came around the corner, and there was Malcolm on the curb. And pulled up, and this fella stopped about 75 feet behind me. And I told Malcolm, I said, "Malcolm, that's the guy that's chasing me." And so Malcolm ran out and opened the door and tried to pull him out and told him, "Citizen's arrest, citizen's arrest." He was driving a Mercedes, by the way. And the guy took off, and Malcolm chased him down the street running, but of course Malcolm wasn't about to catch him. Anyway, that's how Malcolm and I, so I told Malcolm, I said, "Malcolm, you better get out of here." And so Malcolm came over and lived with me. And he worked with me in my, I had a three-bedroom condominium in Las Vegas. And so I noticed, I forget exactly what year it was, but I noticed that I'd sit at my desk and I would have trouble thinking and I couldn't get a clear head and so forth. And so I suspected there was something wrong. So I went down and took a blood test and I found out I had arsenic and cyanide in me. And there's no question they were pumping through the air arsenic and cyanide into my apartment, my condominium. So I told Malcolm, I said, "Malcolm, we got to get out of here." So we left. I called Johnny Camp in Claytonia, Nebraska, which is a town about 35 miles south of Lincoln, Nebraska. And I said, "John, I've got to leave here." And he said, "Well, come on out. I've got a place you can rent." So 2 weeks later, I pulled up after I talked to John and with a van full of furniture. And he rented me a house in Claytonia, a town of 196 people, for $550 a month. It was four bedroom, two baths, on a third of an acre of land. How were you going to buy it and find a better deal than that, huh? And so anyway, we lived there with Malcolm, and then he ended up finding a lady in Des Moines, Iowa, Linda, and they got married. So they brought Linda and little Anna. Who at that time was about 8 years old. Yeah, that was about 2 years ago. Over to Claytonia, and we all three lived together. Now, all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door, and the sheriff's office said that they had received a phone call that we were holding a child hostage.
Oh, no.
And they wanted to see the child. And we said to the officer, "Well, do you have court papers?" And she said, "No." And so we told her to take a hike, and she went out the door and slammed the door, very upset about it. So we realized that Child Protective Services is corrupt in some areas of the country. And so what we did is we moved immediately down the road about 20 miles, put the utilities in the name of Linda's maiden name. It's Clarence Malcolm was my webmaster. And about a couple of weeks after we moved and went in down the road, here comes the police again, knock, knock, knock. "We understand we received information you're holding a child hostage." So I said, "Well, you have papers." And they said, "No." I said, "Take a hike." Okay. So that very afternoon, I said, "I'm going down and talk to the district attorney." His name is Randy Rittenauer. So I went down and talked to Randy Rittenauer. And while I was gone talking to Randy Rittenauer, Malcolm loaded up all his personal possessions. He got in his car and drove to Texas because we were not going to allow that child to be placed in the hands of Child Protective Services, which we think would have happened. So I talked to Randy. I said, "What's going on here?" And he said, "Well, I'm receiving..." Oh, by the way, the sheriff before said that they had received this information, numerous complaints. And Randy Rittenauer, the DA, said, "Well, I'm receiving emails from this woman in California." And I said, "Virginia McCullough?" And he said, "Yeah." He didn't say that, but he shook his head up and down, yes, because he couldn't, you know, I'd reveal his source. So I knew it was Virginia McCullough who's been making disparaging, uncomplimentary remarks about me for years. And by the time I got home, Malcolm was gone. And so then he goes to Amarillo, Texas, where his sister lives, and with his belongings and what have you. We had a 26-foot truck that we bought for $4,000. And now Malcolm is in Texas, and all of a sudden he's under heavy surveillances on a regular basis. And so I shipped Malcolm to save the little girl. I was afraid something would happen to the little girl. She was 8 years old now. I shipped them to Panama, and they went down and lived in Panama for a year and to get them out of harm's way. And that's my associate, Clarence Malcolm. You mentioned him. So that's another story. And by the way, going back to Las Vegas, the guy that brandished the gun on me, I had an elderly lady who I took care of. Her name was Anna Mae Newman. And she's, well, you remember the chili case where the woman said she found a finger, human finger in the chili in California,
uh-huh.
San Jose. Well, the police, that woman was from Las Vegas. And my elderly lady that I was taking care of at the time was watching television when they went in, police went in and arrested her. And standing on the porch, by the way, the fellow that brandished the gun on me, Malcolm did an artist's conception, you know, he drew a picture of him. And so Anna Newman, the woman was watching TV that I take care of, was viewing the television when they arrested this Aloya, I think her name was Aloya, I forget her full name. And there was a man on the front porch, and the reporter says, "Who are you?" And he said he lives here and that he wouldn't talk anymore. Well, Anna Newman recognized the man on the front porch as the person who brandished the gun. And we did a research, and we located a picture of a CIA general, excuse me, not CIA, but a Guatemalan general, who was a known assassin out in Guatemala in his day. And it was identical with that person in the picture, in the CIA picture. Mm-hmm. It was a CIA book about the CIA. So that's kind of an interesting story, too. And we just had one story after another.
So, how do you keep, I mean, when you go through this kind of stuff, what keeps you going? Why do you keep at it? What
I don't know. You have to ask God, Dad. I don't know when I keep going.
Okay, one other aspect. How involved do you think Child Protective Services can be?
You're breaking up.
I'm wondering how much Child Protective Services can be in these incidents.
In some areas of the country, they're definitely corrupt. I had a source in Phoenix tell me that the mafia was involved with these children. And what they would do, the Child Protective Services would take the kids out of the home. You know, that's the Child Protective Services, there's no due process with them. They can come in and seize your child without a court hearing. You don't face your accuser. It's in direct violation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, what they do with these kids. So your neighbor can file a complaint against your child and say that you slapped her, and the CPS can come in and grab that kid without any proof at all of it. And I had a case in Colorado where her name is Judy Chase, and Judy came to me. I helped her with the case, and she told me about how she and her husband, I think his name was Dave, had a place in Colorado, and they adopted two twins. And they had a nanny. They hired a nanny to help take care of the children. And her husband was working contract work with the fellow next door. And he came home one day and said there's some things going on there he didn't like. And the next thing she knew, her husband disappeared, and they found his body in the river with his hands severed, hanging on by the skin. And In the meantime, the nanny who had been hired to come in to take care of the kid, the courts said that Judy Chase could not handle that kid along with this nanny, and they took the kid away from Judy, supposedly legally, and the nanny ended up with the kid, and Judy thinks that the kid's involved in the twins, I'm talking about the twins, for pornography. And Judy's life has never been the same. She's been threatened. There have been dead animals and dead rats on her front door. There have been signs drawn in the alley where she lives, and she lives here in Los Angeles now. And so this is just typical of people that take on these people. And Judy's, in fact, you ought to get Judy on your show sometime.
Okay. All right. I'd like to get Noreen Gosh, too, but...
Yeah, she's kind of faded into the woodwork for some reason. We're trying to get her involved in a national network. I'm so busy myself that, you know, I receive 18, 20 phone calls a day. I just can't keep up with them.
I bet, because there's not a lot of people out there doing the kind of work you do, are there?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah. These are just a couple of cases that I've been involved in.
Right. Now, I'd kind of change direction a little bit. I'd kind of like to acquaint the audience with some of the other cases that you've been involved in. Do you want to get into any of those at all?
Well, gosh, I've worked on many of them. I can't keep track of them. These are the more prevalent.
Okay, all right. Well, let me get into one of the reasons why I was finding out these threads going through various things. When I was interviewing Jim Rostein last week, he was saying that he ended up down in the Oklahoma City bombing investigation because of a case like we were just talking about. Did you were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing investigation too, weren't you?
Oh yeah, sure. I did my own investigation. I have a 222-page report that's on this the CD that I mentioned earlier, and it's on the website tedgunderson.net, the CD. And the morning of the bombing, I received a phone call from Michael Reconosciuto.
Yeah, now
and Michael told me, Michael was a CIA scientist for 20 years. He told me, he says, Ted, that's my bomb. That had the characteristics of my bomb. Michael and his dad owned Hercules Manufacturing in Silicon Valley, California. And they developed this electrohydrodynamic gaseous fuel devices. It's a bomb, a special bomb. I'll call it a barometric bomb. They developed this bomb there, and when it was tested, hang on a minute.
Okay.
When it was tested in 1982, in Area 51, its strength is underestimated, and one of the technicians died, and another one was seriously injured. And it's highly classified. They put a high classification on it, top secret. And... anyway, so I did a little research, and actually one of my associates did the research, and we found the contract number for this bomb. By the way, this report is my Oklahoma City bomb report, again, is available on this CD I mentioned. And so I wrote to Picatinny Arsenal with the contract number, and they wrote back and said, there's no such contract here. Well, I happen to know that there is a contract there. So, and then one of my listeners wrote about several years later, and they came back with the same information, no such contract. But the Oklahoma City bombing was definitely an inside job. Timothy McVeigh, I'm convinced, was a mind control victim. He may or may not be alive today. I know that he was visited by Dr. Jolly West. Jolly West was a mind control, along with Sidney Gottlieb. One of the leaders in the MKUltra mind control program, and he was visited by Dr. West in Oklahoma when he was incarcerated there, and also in Colorado when he was incarcerated in Denver, Colorado,
okay.
In connection with the trial that took place there.
Okay, before you go any further, I want to just visit here with something, because this is something that I'm also finding out to be a thread that kind of goes through so many areas. Is this mind control, be it via black boxes or our televisions or whatever? Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay,
uh-huh.
All right, because it kind of sounded like it faded out. But anyway, so this mind control thing, there's so many avenues and so many ways that via propaganda, via, you know, programming, you name it. It is so prevalent in our lives. And
definitely. You're breaking up, by the way. I hope I can last the rest of the show. Are you there?
You're doing fine. I'm.
Yeah, it's you see, the mind control program is originated in the United States through an code word paperclip. This was a program coming out of Nazi Germany in 1947, right after World War II. We brought Operation Paperclip. We brought these German scientists in, something like 900 of them in, and they infiltrated into government reservations, hospitals, and installations and universities and so forth, and continued the program. And what it is, it's a torture, sleep deprivation, and drugs, and a combination of all these factors, and the trauma involved in it develops different personalities. And so and they've continued it. Now, I think it was 1987, members of Congress, August and September 87, I think it was, there was a committee organized to look into the MK Ultra Mind Control Program. And it was an operation by the CIA, by the way, the mind control program was. And the committee told the CIA to quit doing this sort of thing. And so they said, okay, we will. But, of course, they continued it. And it's called a Monarch now instead of MK Ultra, because its popularity was so well known, the name MK Ultra was so well known. So that's the real slight version of it, but I'm convinced that Saran Saran, who was accused of killing Bobby Kennedy, that Timothy McVeigh was a mind control victim, I don't know about Lee Harvey Oswald. I wouldn't be surprised.
I've heard that, but what it seems to be a lot of is they love to use. These guys like to do the same thing over and over again, because if it worked before, it'll work again. And that these guys, they love the lone gunman scenario, and this Manchurian candidate seems to be prevalent, right?
Oh yeah. Well, of course, this was in a movie, Manchurian Candidate with Frank Sinatra years ago, and it's interesting that these programs are exposed in movies ahead of time, and people think, this is Hollywood, you know, it doesn't mean anything. But oftentimes Hollywood comes out with this information ahead of anybody else, prior to anybody else. But it's there, it's been proven it's there. We had this congressional committee. By the way, my reports on the mind control program, MK Ultra, are also available on this CD.
you support yourself.
Reports.
You pretty much just support yourself with this this work. I mean, I see where you put a lot of your own money into these investigations.
Put thousands. Yeah. I put thousands of dollars into it. Yeah.
Right, and I mean, and you need to be commended for it, because I mean, my goodness, you know, this stuff isn't inexpensive to do, and the information needs to get out there, because it, you know, it's not like it's something that happened years ago and it's not continuing on. It's throughout our whole, I mean, that's why we're in the mess we're in, is because we've let things like this go.
Oh, absolutely. No, I spent thousands of dollars of my own money. I traveled to Oklahoma City twice, investigated. By the way, speaking of Oklahoma City, I have the TV news broadcast the afternoon of the bombing. And there were four or five TV stations that announced they were bringing bombs out of the building. So I started to tell you that the hydrodynamic gaseous fuel device bomb was a bomb that was used in the truck. It wasn't a fertilizer bomb. No fertilizer bomb is going to take away half of the Oklahoma City Murrah building. If you notice it, half the building was missing and in a half moon shape. And there were four conventional bombs that were taken out. So I think that they were supposed to go off simultaneously with the other bomb in the truck. And they didn't go off. And as a matter of fact, the news broadcast said that one of them said, well, they're bringing these bombs out, and one of them says U.S. Army has a U.S. Army stencil on it. So what more information do you need that it was an inside job?
Now, one of the things I've heard that there may have been something like some kind of a mini nuke or something involved in one of these bombs.
That was the electrohydrodynamic gaseous fuel device. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Because I mean, I have done an interview with Colonel Dan Marvin, and he had said that he'd been trained back in the early 60s to carry one of these type of bombs, possibly, or a mini nuke. I don't know about that one, but and possibly to have worked with to blow up the Aswan Dam, which didn't happen. But he spoke of how he was trained to do such a thing. So.
This barometric bomb was powerful, very powerful.
Okay, and so. Go ahead, and I mean, because this Reconosciuto case, I'd like to hear quite a bit more about him, because.
Well, Michael, he's an interesting character, and if you Google him, his name is Michael J. Reconosciuto, RiconosCiuto, Michael J. Reconosciuto, and. As I said, Michael was a scientist, CIA scientist for two decades. And back in the 1980s, Nancy and Bill Hamilton developed the Promise software. Now, the Promise software kept track, and they leased it to the U.S. Department of Justice. It kept track of everything that we did, bank accounts, telephone records, even if you drive your car over a toll bridge, and you're on one of those automatic checks where it registered, and you go through. Even that, it went to that extent. So this Promise software was very, very interesting, and the Department of Justice ran it, leased it for 2 years from the Hamiltons. And at the end of 2 years, they refused to pay the Hamiltons. I think it was $20 million, $10 million a year for them. And refused to give it back to them. And a fellow named Earl Bryan, past president of the United Press International. This information I'm passing on to you is from Michael Reconosciuto, by the way. Earl Bryan took this Promise software and sold it around the world. Canada, French, England, and the Israelis, and other countries. And what these other foreign countries did not know was that they saw this Promise software had a trap door in it, which enabled the United States government to secretly steal the intelligence information that was being developed by these foreign countries. And Michael, when he was a CIA scientist, was the person who built the trap door into the computer. So that was interesting enough, and it got the attention of Congress, and the Brooks Committee had a hearing in the late 80s, early 90s, and they called on Michael to testify. 8 days before he was to testify, he received a phone call from a fellow named Peter Vitniks with the U.S. Department of Justice, and Vitniks told him, if you testify, you'll be sorry. Michael testified anyway, and it was shortly thereafter that Mike was arrested for methamphetamine manufacturing, and Michael had a mining operation in northern Washington State where he used chemicals. And the government claimed that he had produced methamphetamine at this particular location. And Michael was tried and convicted and sentenced to 30 years. Michael, to this day, claims he's innocent. As a matter of fact, I visited with Michael just this last weekend. He's right here down the road at Terminal Island. So Michael's quite a character. He is the person who developed the barometric bomb. And the bomb that was used in Oklahoma City was actually built by the government, but Michael's the one that designed it and so forth. So if you want to, but again, if you Google Reconosciuto, you'll find a very interesting person. There's a couple of books out, The Octopus, The Last Circle, and so forth, that you'll find very interesting. What, Sherry Seymour.
Oh, yeah, I was just listening to an interview with her. Go ahead.
Yeah, she just put a book out. Has she been on the circuit now?
I just heard her. I can't remember what program I caught her on, but it was an interesting interview. She definitely, I think, did she write that book through Trine Day?
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There seem to be the only publishing company that gets into these.
That's the one, that's the outfit out of Oregon?
I think so, right.
Yeah, well, he's good for him, you know, because nobody else is going to publish it. They don't want this information to get out. But anyway, Sherry Seymour's is a very interesting book. And in fact, I think I should talk to Sherry about carrying it on my website.
Yeah, so now was Reconosciuto, was he involved, was Gary Webb involved with anything around that, or was that?
Yeah, Gary Webb, San Jose Mercury News, exposed the CIA bringing drugs to South Central Los Angeles. And he ended up being fired and being a freelance journalist. And then he committed suicide. He was shot himself in the head twice.
And now, was it tied in with Michael somewhere, or did they know each other? Was there some kind of contact?
They knew each other or not, but
okay.
You know, you don't shoot yourself in the head twice if you commit
suicide. No, no. I mean, that's you run into a lot of situations that seems to kind of go around the.
That's right. And Danny Castellaro.
Okay, maybe that's where it was. Danny Castellaro is the one I'm.
Yeah, talking. Danny was. In fact, Sherry Seymour finished up what Danny started to do, and you know, it's a funny thing. These people. They will murder one of us, in suicide or whatever you want to call it, and then somebody comes in right behind them and finishes the job. So they cannot avoid the exposure, because there's always, when they eliminate one, there's always going to be one or two more that will pick up the pieces, like Sherry Seymour has done. And I highly recommend the book to you folks, by the way. As a matter of fact, I just came up with the idea. I think I better start carrying it on my website.
Now, did you work with Nick Bryant any on the cover-up?
Nick Bryant did the Franklin scandal.
Right, right.
Yeah. I gave Nick Bryant all my research, and I used it in the back of the book. The Finder's Report is in the back of the book if you have a copy of it there. I'm sure he got that from me, because I gave that to him. And then he ended up in the book. He didn't give me acknowledgement, but he ended up in the book saying that he had received research from an individual who was a fringe lunatic.
Uh-oh.
So I'm pretty sure that I'm the fringe lunatic.
Now, that's one of the things that I did run across a little bit when I was doing some Googling you, that, you know, there are those that are going to disparage people out there that are, you know, really trying to do some legitimate work out there, isn't there?
Well, Lynn Horton. Now, see, I exposed Virginia McCullough when she tried to put this little child, Anna, into child protective service. I exposed her on the Internet. That's on my website. So as soon as I exposed her, along comes Lynn Horowitz. And he submits a 12-page document, it's on the Internet, by the way, claiming that I service Michael Aquino. Michael Aquino is one of the founders of the Temple of the Church of Satan and the Temple, and later the Temple of Set.
Did you do any investigating around any of his stuff, or?
I know a lot about Michael Aquino. Yeah, he was charged with child molestation, and the San Francisco Police Department did an investigation, and the FBI found out about it and came in and ordered the investigation and the reports all destroyed. And he was never tried.
But
if you go on the internet with Michael Aquino, you're going to learn that he's quite a character. He was a top official in NSA, and he's a colonel in the military, and he was in the Presidio PX on this one occasion. That's how he was initially exposed. And a little boy saw him and told his mother, he said, "Man, that mommy, that's the man that molested me." And then as a result of that, they had the big investigation by the San Francisco police, and nothing ever came of it. Because he has been with the NSA, and he has pull. This is, again, infiltration into the top levels of our government. Yeah, I know all about Michael Aquino. And as I said, Horowitz claims that I, in addition to servicing, whatever that means, Michael Aquino, that I married Anton LaVey's widow, I forget her name, Diana something, and which is absolutely ridiculous, and I'm offering anybody $1 million if they will find a marriage license that's legitimate on that one. And she was, Anton LaVey was one of the founders of the Church of Satan. But Bo Greitz has an expression, and it's called, "If the flak is heavy, you know you're over the target." And the flak is heavy for me, like Virginia McCullough's, Lynn Horowitz's, Stu Webb. A FBI informant named Stu Webb claims that I was kicked out of the FBI for practicing satanic ceremonies in the federal building, whereas I actually had 600 people at my party, the governor, Jerry Brown, the former governor, Pat Brown, chief of police, sheriff, head of the highway patrol. They were all at my party. And then I had run for a political office in 1996. And my campaign manager, Jim Kloberg, he sabotaged my campaign, stole money from the campaign. I located the bank account where he put the money and where the mail drop that he used to solicit and steal the money, and gave it to the FBI, which is an electoral law violation. That then never even came to interview me. This is all documented. And this is all in those 52 reports, 6,500-page CD that's on my website.
Now, Stu Webb, he worked out of Denver or had some tie-in with Denver, from what I recall. I mean, I'd run across some of his work on the net. And did anything he come up with, did you feel like he had any kind of legitimacy in any of the reports that he did? Or
He had no legitimacy at all. He's just an FBI informant that's put out there to put out disinformation. Along with, I'm pretty sure it's FBI. I know that Kloberg was FBI because my sources told me that. And I know that he was arrested for assault and for burglary. Stu Webb was, and he got a suspended sentence in Las Vegas. So you don't get arrested for assault and burglary and get suspended sentences unless you're working with the government. And of course, he lived with me for some 7 months. And I think that's when he developed him as an informant. He would, he's the kind of person he'd sell his grandmother for $5.
Huh.
Yeah. Oh, no, these scoundrels are out there.
Yeah, so they come, I mean, that's the kind of, I mean, there's a lot of those, I mean, quite a number of them out there that will come up to you and befriend you, correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's part of the MO, modus operandi. And as a matter of fact, in the last 30 years since I got out of the FBI, I'd estimate 18 to 20 people planted on me. And there have been occasions when on two occasions I had gunmen waiting for me. And through divine intervention, I didn't go. Didn't go home those two nights.
Isn't that amazing?
I found out later that there was somebody waiting for me.
So
there is a God, believe me, or I wouldn't be here.
Well, this we'll have to do again sometime. You're just a wealth.
Beg your pardon?
I said this is, we'll have to do again sometime. There's just so.
Well, I kind of ran the gambit on you tonight.
Yeah, I know you did, but you know, there's I know from listening some of your interviews, there's more in there, but it, you know, that's down the road. I can see, but
sure.
I just feel that this subject is really important, and that, you know, people realizing that there are people out there willing to take the risk and do the work to try to expose what the kind of, you know, corruption and, I mean, between the drug trade and many other aspects out there that, you know, and I mean, do we want to live in a world full of that, or do we want to live in a world that, you know, you can walk down the street and not have to worry about your kids being snatched, you know?
That's right. That's right.
And
well, I had all this training in the FBI, and I don't know, I just, in fact, in 1986, I think it was, I decided I'd go get out of the cops and robbers business and go on the export-import business, and I ended up losing a lot of money, and it didn't work out. So I guess God wanted me to stay back into this business.
It looks like this one cost you too, though.
Pardon?
As it looked like this one has cost you a little bit too, but,
yeah.
But at least it's a, you know, a worthy cause. But you know, Ted, I want to thank you for coming on the program and to keep up the good work and you know, let's hope that we, you know, can make a dent in what's going on out there. And at this point in time, I have to wonder, but unless we get the information out there and you know, kicking over the rocks, you know, finding these, you know, what's hidden in plain sight, you know, that's.
Well, I know. Well, you know, I have to do what I have to do, and I have no qualms. What you see is what you get with me.
Well, again, I want to thank you very much, and hanging in there after the trying to get in and getting dropped there. But thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to your people.
Okay, good night.
Check my website, folks.
Yeah, tedgunderson.net.
Yeah, Google me. You'll find some interesting material there.
Okay, good night.
Good night, thanks.